Hello and welcome to this first look exploring session. I say it's a first look. There isn't really much room for a second look on this particular session, because today we are looking at the England's Joy affair. The England's Joy incident, which occurred on the 6th of November 1602, or did it? And what we're doing today is taking three people who hopefully know nothing about this particular incident, and we're just going to read through the primary evidence. Now, I may not have all of the primary. I think I've got all the primary evidence here. There is some secondary evidence we could sift through, and there's certainly an awful lot of stuff about the central figure of this, Richard Venner, or Venard. Even his name is something of a mystery, who, let's just say, has many law cases to his name. But we're not going to go that deep into this. But we are going to look at something that happened on the 6th of November 1602 at the Swan Theatre. The Swan Theatre being a theatre that lasted a long time, but had an awful lot of bad luck associated with it. It did have a tendency to get shut down or be largely absent of playing companies for quite a long time, for the length of its existence. I mean, I'm quite fascinated by it. It's a fascinating theatre, built around 1595 ish, and so it's been around for about 7 years, but it got shut down almost immediately because of the Isle of Dogs disaster, a play that we no longer have. And so it's not been as busy a theatre as perhaps it should have been. Reading this particular text today, we have Alan Scott, Aliki Chapel, and Sarah Blake. I'm your host, Robert Crichton. I normally say at this point, I'll be reading stage directions. There are no stage directions. There is no play to read. But what we do have is the plot of the play called England's Joy, to be played at the Swan this 6th of November 1602. Now, a plot has potentially two meanings in this context, or in fact possibly three meanings in this context. Backstage plays would have a plot, a very basic layout of entrances for major characters, and a basic layout of what happens in scenes. So X people walk on, X person says a speech, other people walk on. A very simple outline so that anyone who's rushed off stage can quickly go, what am I doing next? Excellent. And there might have been more of those kind of things. It also, in this context, may function as a playbill, in the sense of something that was pasted up to advertise what was happening in the play. This may not be the case in this case. It may be, alternatively, option number three for this particular document, it might be that this was more like a program for those who came to the show. What I will say about the show, before we read the plot, is that, so this is either advertising, description, or even backstage useful material. I'm probably going to go with program notes, possibly slash playbill, as the most likely elements here. So it's been organised by a chap called Richard Venner, or Venard, depending on your point of view, whether there's a D at the end or whether it's silent or not. It's a private show. He's a private individual, and he's decided to organise, hire the Swan Theatre and put on this. So this is what was performed, to be decided, on the 6th of November 1602. And I'll ask Alan to read the first bit, Sarah to read the second bit, and Aliki to read the third bit. And then we will pause.
First, there is induct by show and in action the Civil Wars of England from Edward III to the end of Queen Mary's reign, with the overthrow of usurpation.
Secondly, then the entrance of the England's Joy by the coronation of our sovereign Lady Elizabeth, a throne attended with peace, plenty, and civil policy, a sacred prelate standing at her right hand, betokening the serenity of the gospel, at her left hand, justice, and at her feet, war, with the scarlet robe of peace upon his armour, a wreath of bays about his temple, and a branch of palm in his hand.
Thirdly is dragged in three furies, representing dissension, famine, and bloodshed, which are thrown down into hell.
Okay, so we've got no real detail about what's going on. This is a third of the plot. There's nine items. And it looks like it's doing a lot of history and stuff. First impressions from the room as to what you're reading. I mean, you've been about the block a bit with Beyond Shakespeare. You've done pretty much on and off everything that's up to about this year. Not necessarily everything, but you've been about. I'll go to Sarah first, then Aliki.
Well, it's all starting off quite sort of jolly and kind of what I would expect. It's I'm thinking of Ben Jonson, of course, and his very detailed stage directions that he used to give. That this isn't as detailed. We get some of those glorious costume details in Jonson, but we've got, you know, we've got War with a Scarlet Robe of Peace upon his armour and Aretha Bays about his temple and a branch of palm in his hand. So far it's kind of sounding quite normal, she says hesitatingly. It's not sounding, I don't think it's sounding particularly strange. The figures there, I mean, okay, dissension, famine and bloodshed, I'm thinking the plot's going to be quite violent, but, like, yeah, it's sounding okay.
Aliki?
To me it sounds like civic pageantry more than like a play. It's like, here is the queen, isn't she great? Here is all the bad things that came before the queen, they are cast down into the pit.
Alan.
I'm just wondering, are we at the start of the sort of the mask era with this?
Well, in a sense, the revival of mask as a really expensive, extravagant thing, like Ben Jonson's writing. You know, Ben Jonson is about to start writing the really elaborate masks, but we're not quite there yet because the Queen's still alive. Queen's got a few more months left in her. And that's an interesting discussion of Sovereign Lady Elizabeth. They're depicting the Queen. She's still alive, people. which is sort of why I lean against this being an advertised playbill, because you really don't do that kind of thing in a public theatre, even if it's a private gig, as this sort of is. I mean, it's a really interesting thing about what's happening here. It's not a playing company doing this. This is a private gig, but is for a paying audience. So is it private or is it public? What is this event? It's really weird. Sarah?
Do we know for certain that it was for a paying audience?
Oh, yes.
Oh, right, okay.
More details on that anon.
All right.
We'll come to the price. It turns up in a later document, so we will come to that. But yeah, I think Aliki's really, really got something there. It does seem to be very civic pageantry-ish. I mean, it may also be a bit like the kind of things you'll get at court as well, but it's presentational. There's no drama here, really. But then there's this sort of old-fashioned morality tale style elements as well, which you get in pageantry too. You get furies, dissension against England's joy. So England's joy is at the coronation of Elizabeth, who makes everything great, because it's this thing. You have the Civil Wars of England is your opening gambit, and then Liz turns up and everything's cool. There's no dissension under Elizabeth.
No.
Nobody rebelled, ever.
Nobody rebelled at all.
They didn't burn anyone. Actually, she burnt quite a few people, actually. Let's just be clear here. Not quite as enthusiastically as previous monarchs, but definitely a pretty steady rate of burnings to keep the home fires warm. Anyway, let's read on. Alan 4, Sarah 5, Aliki 6, please.
Fourthly, is expressed under the person of a tyrant, the envy of Spain, who to show his cruelty causeth his soldiers drag in a beautiful lady, whom they mangle and wound, tearing her garments and jewels from off her, and so leave her bloody, with her hair about her shoulders, lying upon the ground. To her come certain gentlemen, who, seeing her piteous despoilment, turn to the throne of England, from whence one descendeth, taketh up the lady, wipeth her eyes, bindeth up her wounds, giveth her treasure, and bringeth forth a band of soldiers, who attend her forth. This lady presenteth Belgia.
Fifthly, the tyrant, more enraged, raketh counsel, sends forth letters, privy spies, and secret underminers, taking their oaths and giving them bags of treasure. These signify Lopor and certain Jesuits, who afterward, when the tyrant looks for an answer from them, are showed to him in a glass with halters about their necks, which makes him mad with fury.
Sixthly, the tyrant, seeing all secret means to assail him, intendeth open violence and invasion by the hand of war, whereupon is set forth the Battle of the Sea in 88, with England's victory.
So, we've got a villain. You know, we've set up the good queen, who is England's joy, and now we have the envy of Spain, culminating in this particular chunk with the Spanish Armada of 88. But yeah, there's quite a graphic description for section four. Sarah, you blanched positively.
I was not expecting that. I was not expecting Belgium to.
Nobody expects
to have such a sensational time of it. And I mean sensational in the old-fashioned sense of the word. Yes, poor Belgium, her piteous despoilment. My history of this era is not very good, but Belgium, bits of...
yeah, we've got to be
Flemish
a bit
Belgium was under the rule of Spain at this point, wasn't it? So, yeah. Yeah. Yes. Very. It reminded me this of one of those like Victorian penny dreadful pamphlets that you'd get about, you know, the horrid true crime of, you know, Miss Lavinia, who was pulled into an alleyway by a dreadful rogue and, you know, had the feathers stolen from her hat. Yes.
It's like First World War propaganda, actually, isn't it? Because that was, wasn't
oh,
it?
Oh, yeah, was Belgium. Yeah, it was.
Belgium.
Yeah.
Mm. Well, I mean, we've got, actually, from about this time, just checking his timeline here, we've got specific plays happening about the Siege of Antwerp. So Alarum for London was a couple of years before this, I think, if I can find it, which I'm currently struggling to do. But that was specifically all about the terrible Spanish doing terrible things in Belgium. And so I wonder if that's the author has taken this and run with it as a thing. Maybe it's early, even earlier than that. I can't find it on my list. Oh, well, never mind. Other thoughts. It sort of makes we've got the fifthly, all the spies, all those yes. those dastardly Jesuits. You know, we're only 3 years away from the gunpowder plot, almost exactly. You know, this isn't wholly, you know, this is one of those awkward things because it's not wholly paranoia. You know, the Catholic powers are out to get England and trying to kill the Queen, but it is also rampant paranoia, and it's really interesting where you sort of judge that. But it's all sensationalist, isn't it? It's all
very much so. Yeah, it's also I mean, obviously, because this is a plot, and there is no dialogue. It's just got a wonderful quality to it. I mean, you know, as you read it. As you read the descriptions, you see them in your head being acted out in like a dumb show in a very, yes, exactly, in a very mannered kind of way. And it's all kind of fabulous, isn't it? Like, well, what's going on in my head is fabulous anyway, but like it's just it's a bit of a hoot. And I'm already beginning to become very intrigued about why this came to be, this show, and why it was done, and what the motivation was behind, you know, staging it.
Mm, yes. Why did he write it? How much of it was written? You know, how much of this is text? Because we're talking about dumb show. Is this, you know, is this just a massive dumb? You know, is this? You know, hiring out the Royal Albert Hall and just doing a massive display extravaganza, or is this something different? I do not know. I don't know how much the text will actually tell us. They will give us some more detail. Anyway, we will read on. Alan 7, Sarah 8, Aliki 9.
Seventhly, he can plot us with the Irish rebels, wherein is laid open the base ingratitude of Tyrone, the landing there of Don John de Anguilla, and their dissipation by the wisdom and valour of the Lord Mountjoy.
Eighthly, a great triumph is made with fighting of 12 gentlemen at barriers, and sundry rewards lent from the throne of England to all sorts of well-deservers.
Lastly, the 9 worthies, with several coronets, present themselves before the throne, which are put back by certain in the habit of angels, who set upon the lady's head, which represents her majesty, an imperial crown garnished with the sun, moon, and stars. And so with music, both with voice and instruments, she is taken up into heaven. When presently appears a throne of blessed souls, and beneath, under the stage, set forth with strange fireworks, diverse black and damned souls, wonderfully described in their several torments.
It's packing a lot in. He's packing a lot in. Who wants to go first? Alan.
It's beginning to remind me of a student show. You know, oh, well, we can't do anything else. Let's just play with costume and effects.
I'm finding this whole thing about the ascension of the Queen into heaven very entertaining, but also kind of, surely this would have been a bit dodgy. Would it not? For all kinds of reasons. I mean,
Catholic.
It's very, well, yes, exactly. It's very, very Catholic. And also the Queen is still alive at this point. And I mean, I know... She's not well. She's clinging on. But, you know, for them to kind of visualise the death of the Queen before it had actually happened and then make it so Catholic, it's like... They were on very thin ice here, weren't they? What the hell were they thinking?
This is why I'm thinking this must be a program note rather than a playbill to tell people what was going on. Because the spits here, I'm just going, someone would shut this down, surely. Because, I mean, the whole ascension thing is very much like a mystery play. The kind of mystery play that's been banned for 50 years. Not you know, some mystery plays continue rattling on and are still in some parts of the country, maybe still being performed by now. But basically, you know, your ascension from 1533, it gets really difficult to do any of those, and they get pulled relatively quickly. And once the Reformation get going. But, you know, we've got music, we've got voice, we've got instruments, and then we've got the damned souls. So it's yes. a doomsday mystery play as well. So I'm just wondering, did he just nick a mystery play and think he can whack it in at the end?
But also, not only do we have the damned souls, but we have them wonderfully described in their several torments. Like, what kind of show was this?
Yeah. Red hot spits.
Yeah.
Red hot spits. You know. But we have skipped over a couple of things. So, seventhly, we had the Irish rebels, because, you know, that's a war that is still just about... I don't think they've actually... concluded it yet. I think there's another year or two to go. I think it's under James that it's finally put to bed. I could be wrong on that. I forget, but it was definitely still rumbling on a few years ago, and we've got an awful lot of plays about wounded soldiers with missing limbs. So there is a sort of real sort of connection there. Again, going back to some of the plays we've seen in playhouses. But then we have a great triumph with fighting of 12 gentlemen at barriers. Mm-hmm. So we get a sword, whacking great sword fight going on. I'm assuming they didn't bring horses in to do tilts. But it just feels like, and now we're just going to have a sword fight. We're going to have a massive fight.
Does say it barriers, though.
Yeah, I know, it's weird, isn't it? Because yeah. I was just going, I don't know how that works. We haven't done enough tilt and barrier techs yet to sort of really know what might be going on here. Mm. I mean, again, we're not going to get any more data on this particular bit of text, I should just point out. So, but, you know, some, you know, Crazy 88, come on and do some fighty action or something. Aliki, are you...
Yeah, I mean, who's this Lord Mountjoy character? Mm. We've had the Queen, we have the bad Don John, and then suddenly, out of nowhere, here's somebody else coming in for some great praise. So that was interesting.
I assume he was part of the Irish campaign in some fashion. I don't know enough about it off the top of my head to
yeah, but he gets singled out by name for praise, and the only other person who does that, to whom that is done here, is the Queen. So
yeah, I mean, at the moment, I'm only thinking the only way you could make this more. Dangerous is to actually have Essex turn up. But luckily there's no mention. Alan.
Yeah, Mountjoy rings bells with me from distant recollection of that period of history. Mm. I think he was one of the lead players, and I have a funny feeling that he may have been Essex's number two.
It's either that or he
point
came
when
in
Essex had fallen from grace.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if he's the one who follows up and actually does something effective, and probably brutal and horrible that we won't worry about at this particular time. Okay, so that's the plot. Now, imagining that this was a play, Bill, would you want to go and see this show?
I totally would. I totally would, because I'd just be like, WTF? What are they doing? I need to go and see this in all its disastrous glory.
Okay. Now, if you go to the Swan normally, probably, we can't be 100% certain about some of the prices, but if you were to be a standing ticket, would be a penny, okay? Tickets for this are going at 2 shillings or 18 pence.
Wow, that's a lot.
It's a lot of money.
There must be really, really impressive several torments for the damned for me to come turn up for that.
Yeah.
I mean, I want spurting blood and...
Yeah. Mm. Well, a rack in size, you know.
We get the Spanish Armada, people. we're going to have the Battle of Sea in 88. So, you know, this is going to be good.
It's a spectacular.
Yeah. Okay,
and did I see fireworks as well? Yes, strange fireworks.
Mm.
So, you know, not just any old firework, strange fireworks.
Yeah. So, okay. So that's what's advertised. You turn up on the Saturday. It's a Saturday. Saturday, 6th of November, 1602, and the show happens? We're now going to go to our next document, which may not make a lot of sense to you. But they will start making more sense. So these are things written in people's diary and or letters about what happened. So I'll ask Aliki, could you read the first entry to John Manningham's diary on the 12th of November? So this is 6 days later, 1602.
Venar, a gentleman of Lincoln's Inn, who had lately played a notable coney-catching trick and gulled many under colour of a play to be of gentleman and reverence, coming to the court, since in a black suit, boots and golden spurs without a rapier. One told him he was not well suited, the golden spurs and his brazen face unsuited.
So, we're getting a few hints as to elements here. Venar is not unused to going to court, and he's He's wearing a black suit at the moment. yeah, all sorts of interesting data here. A leaky.
So coney catching is a confidence trick, a scam.
Yes, yes. The mark, in modern parlance, the mark is a coney that gets catched. According to John Manningham. Okay, John Manningham continues writing another line on the 27th of November. Oh, I didn't get that in sequence. Never mind. But we'll continue with John Manningham. Alan, just read the next couple of lines.
When one says that Venner, the grand coney catcher, had golden spurs and a brazen face, it seems, said R.R., he had some metal in him.
So, again, not all of this will be making sense. There's a lot of reference to spurs, which may or may not become clear in a moment. But he's the grand coney catcher now. Give it a couple of weeks, and now he's the grand coney catcher. Sarah, this may help. John Chamberlain... writes a letter to Dudley Carlton on the 19th of November, 1602.
And now we are in mirth. I must not forget to tell you of a cozening prank of one Venner of Lincoln's Inn that gave out bills of a famous play on Saturday with Seven Knight on the Bankside, to be acted only by certain gentlemen and gentlewomen of account. Price at coming in was 2 shillings, or 18 pence at least, and when he had gotten most part of the money into his hands, he would have showed them a fair pair of heels, but he was not so nimble to get up on horseback, but that he was fain to forsake that course and betake himself to the water, where he was pursued and taken and brought before the Lord Chief Justice, who would make nothing of it but a jest and a merriment, and bound him over in £5 to appear at the sessions. In the meantime, the common people, when they saw themselves deluded, revenged themselves upon the hangings, curtains, chairs, stools, walls, and whatsoever came in their way very outrageously, and made great spoil. There was great store of good company, and many noble men.
So, now, I should point out we haven't finished. There will be more. We're going to hear from Richard Venner's point of view later on. But in terms of this particular account, we are getting a very clear point of view. There's interesting details before we get onto liability. Is that we have gentlemen and gentlewomen performing. So this, again, it feels more like a courtly entertainment than it does a public play. But it is a public play for an awful lot of money. And it seemed that he tried to get away on horseback. This is probably why they keep mentioning spurs in his diary, is that he was quick to his spurs to get away. So that might be what that's referring to there. I might have misread that. But yes, a lot of money, and the audience weren't pleased.
This is as I was reading this, I'm thinking, oh, I'm back in the Jests of George Peel territory here. This is exactly the kind of thing that the fictional Peel would come up with to earn himself some cash. I mean, this is exactly the kind of prank that he would play. Also, the fact that from the previous entry, it seems said R.R., he hath some metal in him. I wonder if anyone took a shot at him as he was retreating. And the metal in question was lead.
So he tries to get away on horseback. He fails. He tries to get to the water and he's taken. And I feel sorry, I say, for whoever's owning the Swan at this point, because, as I say, it's not a very lucky theatre. And it's just a riot has clearly stripped anything that's movable from the place. Because they want their money back. And, hey, what are you going to go for? So it's an interesting question of how well laid out the space was. I mean, was it made to look amazing in preparation for an event? This is the question, okay? At this stage, you may not be able to answer this. But, you know, according to the accounts, this was, a deliberate con. Or at least according to John Chamberlain. Now, is it a deliberate con, or was just Venner out of his depth? And that is the question that we will grope for an opinion on here. Because, did he try and run away with the money? At what point did he try and run away with the money? Sadly, as I say, this is all primary evidence up to this point. Any opinions from the room before we go into the longer bit of text that will take us a while to read?
Well, the fact that he shows them a fair pair of heels, I don't know. I'm also thinking of what you were saying about the Swan Theatre. Like, that they not only did the theatre get stripped and gutted by the irate public, but they probably hadn't been paid either. Because I can imagine that, Venner, if he is the con man that he is portrayed as here, he would say, oh, yes, no, I just need you to trick up the stage with some, red. Let's get some nice red. So let's get some scarlet in, and the poor theatre owner had, tricked out the theatre, according to his instructions, thinking that he was going to get really well paid for this extravaganza. And then he just ended up with a ruin.
Okay, so 12 years pass before we get some more data on this. And we have Richard Venner's An Apology, written in 1614. Written by Richard Venner of Lincoln's Inn, abusively called England's Joy, to repress the contagious ruptures of the infected multitude who have diseased stomachs of their own, make the world believe they cast up others' poison. And dedicated to the same purblind multitude who feed with spectacles to make their meat seem bigger, as hoping not altogether unworthy the perusal of the noblest judgments, who may hence either find reason to censure others modestly or sustain their own wrongs lightly. It's a good apology. It's one of those modern apologies, isn't it? I'm
sorry if you feel this way.
Yes. Yeah. I'm sorry if you felt you needed to insult me. It does continue in this vein at great length. And we should have some fun with this, I hope. So we're going to read quite a chunk of this to get a sense of this apology. It's going to go a lot into his life and his backstory, as well as the incident itself. So there's going to be an awful lot of data. But I think it's important to read all of it to get a real sense of it. So this may take a little while, but we will pause occasionally. So Aliki, I'll ask you to take paragraph number one. Alan, if you could take paragraph number two, which is first, therefore. Sarah, here do I. And then if you can effectively rotate amongst yourselves, a leaky Sarah, Alan, leaky Sarah, Alan. That would be lovely. Okay, let's. I'll lead you in. So once again, we get the title: An Apology, written by Richard Venner of Lincoln's Inn, abusively called England's Joy, dedicated to the purblind multitude that feed with spectacles to make their meat seem bigger.
'Twas a wise saying of King Agesilaus, considering the praise of ill men, that the manners of the commenders were to be expected in the commended. From which I have often took occasion to comfort my unjust sufferings, when I considered the calumnies of my rude adversaries would, at least to better judgments, distinguish me from a chicken of their own brood. Neither could I vouchsafe to publish any defence of my former actions, though provoked by the rough tongues of the beast multitude, so long as I considered wise men could not be ignorant of the saying of the wisest, Proverbs 18, verse 3, when the wicked cometh, then cometh contempt, and with the vile man reproach, finding bold-faced fame, who only differs from a harlot in this, mobilitate viget viresque acquirit eundo, gathers strength out of motion, and grows lusty by labor, had took breath from garlic nostrils to infect scarlet bodies, And then chiefly when I thought the full world had been weary of his old bauble, having every day so many new ones brought forth for him to play with, I could not be so insensible to my much injury, having experienced the school theme, veterem ferendo in iuriam in vitus novam, but cast away all respects of difference that might privilege me from so unequal a combat as this, and with the noble Spaniard, provoked by a fellow of ignoble descent, who thus began his challenge, I, Rodrigo de Tormes, being as base a rascal as thyself, do summon thee, Alonso, etc. So I am content, having Solomon's warrant, to answer a fool according to his foolishness, lest he grow proud in his own conceit.
First, therefore, that you may know, my birth promised me in no such competitors. I was son to John Venner of Salisbury, Esquire, commissioner in the peace, a younger brother, I must confess me, as else would manifest itself by the sequent story, to make me appear that which I fear many of you are not, though I wish you were, in condition a Christian. Bishop Jewel administered that sacrament to me, witnessed by two noble earls of Bedford and Pembroke, deceased. The first part of my education committed to Dr. Hill, from whose instruction I proceeded to Balliol College in Oxford, being a fellow commoner in that house 2 years, whence my desires carrying me with the windy humour of travel, I, being young, my father sent me into France, attended by an Italian for my guide, and a serving man and a page for my followers, Henry de Valois being then king, in whose court I purchased such respect that I obtained his letters to Maximilian, then emperor, in my large commendation, where, after some stay, returning through Germany home again, I forthwith admitted myself one of Lincoln's Inn, the most honourable Lord Ellesmere, now Lord Chancellor, being then reader. The fashion of my life, answering my birth and former education so far, that I dare my most malicious detractors to parallel my port and habit with any gentleman under the degree of honourable, maintaining myself, and 6 men, with horses suitable, in that place.
Here do I see some puny show his teeth, coming out with a warm sentence that lies hot in his flesh, yet. Necte collaudes, necte colpaveris ipse, hoc faciunt sciolti quos gloria vexat inanus. To these, I recite the deed of Epaminondas, remembered by Plutarch, who, having overcome the Lacedaemonians in a bloody war, expected the praise of his conquest, had the slaughter of his enemies much extended by his ungrateful countrymen, who, being forced to publish his own praise, commanded the dead bodies should not be buried together, but that every town might seek out their own, by which surge and particular number the general was known to the true demonstration of his before obscured victory.
I have read in a learned modern writer upon that saying of St. Paul in the Acts, I was a Pharisee of the strictest order and brought up at the feet of Gamaliel, that where any good in us may be necessary to exhortation, or of force to take away slander, we may without prejudice name it, helping either to the maintaining of truth or abolishing a lie. If so, then, I hope I have double warrant for this apology, my desert being such that I durst with Themistocles come upon the theatre, and being demanded whose voice he would hear, answered, his that should speak his praises. For as the first part of my life was beneficial to myself by my father's bounty, so the remainder thereof, hitherto, hath been so profitable to my country, even to that insensible beast, mine adversary, that I may boldly affirm no man of my degree in this kingdom hath with more danger of his person and adventure of his estate brought equal benefit to his country. But seeing my case is the same with the philosophers, who, falling in company among thieves and being suddenly overtaken with the scouts and public officers, said to one another, "If we be known, we are undone." He cried out, likewise, on the other side, "Unless we be known, I am undone." To the intent, therefore, I say, that I may be the better discerned from these companions, I will first discover them by laying open the ground upon which they have given judgment of my diseases, which, falling within no compass of judicious principles, I may the better give you a touch of my pulse, which I hope to more sensitive and steady opinions will sufficiently plead my health.
The first wound, then, that my fame received was by a man who had the name of Law to his profession, which he had purchased with prayer and fasting. With much entreaty and with tears, he got certificate that he had long enough combated with slender commons to write Esquire at Lincoln's Inn. This man, that had only wit to defeat me of my patrimony, though otherwise of small discretion, married my elder brother's widow. My father's yet living, who, having given intent to leave his lands to her children, made a deed of gift to me of all his goods to the value of many thousand pounds. Not long after, he pays nature her tribute, and by a supposed will, my brother of the law, in my absence, possessed himself of the estate before given unto me, instead of that portion, laying supposed forgery of that deed to my charge, and further, in malice to weaken my estate, draws me into the Star Chamber. The suit was long, my purse of defence short, my credit and innocency unproportionable. What the one did stretch to, the other was too bad a paymaster for, so that I found many suits begun ere the first was ended. In brief, execution outwent judgment. The King's Bench was elder brother to the Fleet. I had better defence for my cares than my feet, which, though I had heard long ill on all sides, stood still within the compass of my cap. Though there were reasonable evidence to return a verdict of not guilty on my side, yet, since no less than musket proof must serve against such hot shots, you shall take notice. I had composition of £150, which by long imprisonment I was enforced to accept of, whence I hope that the grossest skull may draw this conclusion. Crimes may oft be pardoned, never rewarded. Is that the end of Para?
I think so.
Yeah, pass it on.
Yeah. To the meanest capacity, this sore would seem to have his cure, but hard is my fate to bear that mark which Alexander's parasites advised his fellows to brand the smoothest faced with, namely, ne metuerent quodvis crimem in quemvis entendere quamvis enim vulnus sanetur manet cicatrice. As much as to say that no man should doubt to impose any crime to any man, for though he heal the cut, the scar remains, which counsel Erasmus, not without good cause, calls the most pernicious that ever proceeded from devil, and I have made experiment of it. For presently, after my liberty received, upon some report of my trouble, whose cause carried name enough to slander to those who only took pains to hear my accusation, not answer, a youth of your own train, a head of the same monster in the shape of a gentleman of the Lord Admiral's, having counterfeited his lord's hand and seal for the receipt of £40 out of the storehouse of Deptford, takes a chamber in Chancery Lane, near my house, where, in short time, he took upon him the name of Sick, being, as you have heard, not very found. In the midst of his feigned fit, he sends for me, without witness, delivering me the warrant for the money, and requests my pains in riding to receive it, as I pass that way to my house at Lewisham in Kent. Which project carried thus much safety to himself, that if the sum were delivered, it was easily earned. If it miscarried, it was easily answered, where my avowing was to be avoided by his denial, which, falling upon me with some amazement, brought full astonishment in his confident abjuring. Here was the proverb verified, an ill name half hanged. The old scar being worse than the new hurt to prove my imperfection, all but my unspotted conscience giving me over to the severity of censure, in which trial my tongue, uttering the free language of my heart, wrought so effectually on that honourable treasurer Burley's compassion, that with great judgment and happy success, a straight examination of my counterfeit merchant opened his warehouse, where I was found but a porter, and bore only the weight for a time, which, with some other of the like commodity, broke his neck for suspensus erat. He was to you an example, brethren.
And we'll pause there. It's long-winded, isn't it? There's an awful lot of woe is me stuff going on here. There will be more. There will be a lot more of this. I think Aliki put in the chat, it's like Dominic Cummings' blog. I think that's exactly right, isn't it? It's like he's going to try and blame everybody for, you know, everybody else. And to be fair, there were some complicated things that happened legally with his family that this is referring to, which is a bit out of the scope of what we're doing here. But yeah, you're getting a sense of his personality from the text, aren't we? Alan.
Yeah, bloody Oxford educated lawyer, you know.
Yeah.
Not a dodgy character at all. What amazes me is that this is a dozen years after the event. Why the hell does he want to pick the scab of it?
Well, I mean, what I got from the opening of it was people keep bringing up England's joy. Aye, England's joy! It's like, his reputation is so destroyed. You know, this is very late onset reputation management. It's like people trying to write biographies to resettle the, you know, the narrative later on in their life. And that's exactly what he's trying to do here. He's writing a short autobiography, basically. It's not an apology at all. It's a defense of his reputation. And it's an interesting question. How successful do we think he's doing so far? Sarah?
Well, I'm just thinking, if he opened his umbrella, an entire fish shop would fall out because he's got so many chips on his shoulder. Like, yeah.
But he's got chips on his shoulder because of his background. You know, he's constantly talking about his connections and his royalty and his education. It's just like...
This is the thing. Yeah, there's a massive sense of entitlement going on here. In between all the kind of, you know, oh, woe is me. It's like, well, none of this should be happening to me because, you know, damn it, I'm somebody. It's kind of hilarious, but I mean, actually, yeah, there's one thing about him, like, I mean, he's got a very strong... I'm not talking about his character now, but just the way he writes, he's got a very strong voice. So from the perspective of, like, you know, a performance, you could actually have a lot of fun with this because he's clearly, yeah, he's not saving his reputation here. He's just digging himself into a bigger and bigger hole with this. But, like, that's kind of half the fun. And I assume that this is genuine and he's not doing this on purpose. The whole thing isn't like one big satire. But, you know, it could be. It's kind of on a knife edge.
Yeah, no, I think it has the ring of truth, Aliki.
I just want to check the meaning of apology in this period. And this is me coming at it with my Greek head, where in Greek, apologia means a structured self-defense rather than an I'm sorry.
Mm. I think I would not be surprised if that's the logic of it, though I would have probably then used the actual... Yeah, He's throwing enough Latin in this as we go. Because he's constantly showing his learning and references and all the rest of it in a very tedious way. That's why I'm asking. I haven't just said skip to the end of those bits. I think the tedium is important. I think that's, you know, even if we have no idea what he's saying, that's important. Okay. Let's read on, because we're now actually going to get to some data that's actually relevant to the events we've been discussing. So Aliki, then Alan and Sarah, same pattern, paragraph at a time. Paragraphs are a little shorter, I think.
By this, I may seem like a cunning orator to have produced the weakest imputations first, that their clearing might set the better gloss upon more known defects. For who can excuse my public default of the Swan, where not a collier but calls his dear 12 pence to witness the disaster of the day? How should I, without blushing, deny the name of England's Joy, who had so many gossips at my christening? Surely this devil must be cast out at leisure. You must use some patience to hear, and I rob you of a little more time to deliver the circumstance, which, with indifferency heard, I assure myself will prove but a chimera, and either appear but a wind or Ixion's monster at most, part man, part beast.
Considering then my unjust troubles that wrapped me in many debts, and those hardly satisfied by the former unequal composition, suppose I had only a younger brother's patrimony left me, my limbs and my wits, worst tenants a citizen can let a house to, that to add to my wants, I had the remembrance of my former plenty. With the steward in the gospel, I could exclude myself from labour, and beggary was shameful. I put new wings to my dull hopes, and resolved to go to Scotland, persuading myself that His Majesty's letters would, upon the right, conceiving of my case, persuade with the Lords of the Council here in England to have a hearing of my cause, former agreement notwithstanding.
My coming into Scotland was in anno 1600, the 7th of August, where, to my heart's joy, I beheld His Majesty in triumph, riding towards the church at Edinburgh to offer up his hearty sacrifice of praise and thanksgiving unto that Most High God who had so wonderfully and graciously delivered him from that hell-bred treason of the Gawleys, the most noble and valiant viscounts, Fenton and Haddington, being the instrumental means of his happy deliverance from that horrid danger, whose memorable services therein deserves to be recorded to posterity, even with the most notorious examples of the most noble Romans in the preservation of their prince and country. Is that the end of a paragraph? No, maybe not.
Carry on.
The beholding of which triumphs, together with the exceeding joy of his subjects and His Majesty's most gracious acceptance thereof, did so stir up my affection that it moved me to passion, which, though being there a stranger, I manifested by my tears as outward signs of inward joy.
The next morning, following this blessed day, I writ a prayer in my bed of thanksgiving for His Majesty's happy deliverance, which prayer, without my privity, was presented to His Highness by one Master Duncan Moore, a gentleman of Scotland, and one of the guard to the French king, whereupon I was sent for and graced by kissing his royal hand, after which I attended His Highness to Falkland, where, after some stay, returning to Edinburgh, I was there questioned with by Master George Nicholson, then agent for England, touching my loyalty. And after returning into England and coming to the court, then at Richmond, I was not only apprehended and examined, but also committed for the same as a dangerous member to the state, so that in all my courses my actions have been mistaken, and I unjustly censured.
This new gall of my imprisonment, grating upon the tender skin of my late hurt reputation, made it again to rankle and become an eyesore to that barking beast, the multitude, that ever measure things by their events. And say truth, I'd seldom heard a wise man that lost commended, or a fool that one dispraised, but that the success hath generally overmastered both opinion and report.
This was my entertainment in England after my return out of Scotland, which nevertheless I took the more patiently because it was derived from an innate love in me to that majesty, which I trusted then should afterwards be my sovereign, which happy time is now come. And it is to me so great joy, without flattery be it spoken, that what cross accidents of the world soever happen to me, I shall never disesteem my fortunes in this regard, that after all the storms of my malignant stars, I have, nevertheless, lived to see these happy, halcyon days.
After that little bit of, this little segue to Scotland. It says, you know, I seem to have been mentioning the wrong things first. You're here for England's joy, aren't you? But let me tell you about what happened in Scotland when I met the king. And all these people, these important people, you know who's king now, right? It's just the arse-licking of that last sentence as well. These happy halcyon days. Yes, of course. They're all against me, my lord. Save me from my debtors.
Infamy.
And again, he's really not happy. He doesn't like the people, does he?
Doesn't like the multitude.
The barking beast, the multitude. I don't think he's a natural Labour supporter, is he?
No, I don't think so. Oh, actually, God, yes, like... Sorry, I don't want to go off on a political tangent, but I'm now just thinking of several current modern day politicians who could practically like read this. I mean, Dominic Cummings was a great reference, but actually there are several others as well that I could just hear. I can practically hear this speech coming out of their mouths. Yeah.
Okay, we are now getting more to the point. So we will continue. Aliki and then Alan Sarah, same fashion.
Thus I lived a long time as a bird in a cage, not fed like birds at their keeper's cost, but as a hurt deer in an enclosed ground, hunted with the continual cries of the fastidious and pitiless hellhounds of a jail. Howbeit, I never held myself so fatally unfortunate as to expire my last breath in a prison, for at last I got my freedom, and casting up my reckoning with counters, I've just managed to lose my text. I don't know what happened to it. Ah, there it is. And casting up my reckoning with counters, wanting money for that use and others, my mind became diversely distracted with plurality of purposes, sometimes carried one way, sometimes another. The last that I stood not least upon in resolution was a second intendment for Scotland. But to this purpose there wanted arms, or rather the sinews of arms, money. I saw daily offering to the god of pleasure resident at the Globe on the Bankside of much more than would have supplied my then want. I noted every man's hand ready to feed the luxury of his eye that pulled down his hat to stop the fight of his charity. Wherefore I concluded to make a friend of Mammon and to give them sound for words, both being but air, for which they should give double payment to the intent only. Men of ability might make the purchase without repentance, and myself observe that wife rule of philosophy, non fiat per plura quod potest fiat per pauciora. My device was all sorts of music, beginning with chambers, the harp of war, and ending with hounds, the cry of peace, of which I was doubly provided for fox and hare.
Report of gentlemen and gentlewomen's actions, being indeed the flag to our theatre, was not merely falsification. I had divers chorus to be spoken by men of good birth, scholars by profession, protesting that the business was merely abused by the coming of some beagles upon me that were none of the intended kennel, I mean bailiffs, who, seizing me before the first entrance, spoke an epilogue instead of a prologue. This changed the play into the hunting of the fox, which, that the world may know for a verity, I here promised the next term with the true history of my life, to be publicly presented, to insert, in place of music for the acts, all those intendments prepared for that day's entertainment, which, seeing it must rest in your beliefs till then, I will be content so long to wear your appellation, preferring only in this imputation so far as the part of an apologist, that, drawing the accident itself without defence into judicious question, this Scoggins crow that has filled so many mouths will prove but a rook. To suppose that the play was hissed, was I the first poet made my clown's penitence? Let the burning pestle be heard in my cause, which rang so dismally in your ears, and yet the writer in a state of grace.
The difference was, I presented you with a dumb show, and the players say that is always as good as a bad act. Neither could the cost be great, that for one 12 pence afforded mirth for a 12-month after. At the highest rate you lent me but an afternoon's hearing, the expectation being worth the money, since philosophers say that the sweetness of hope is beyond the enjoying. And in this sense I bettered that day's travel, the error being your own, being that ignorant of a logician, style me in an impostor, from which I am so far that the law shall speak for me, which presupposeth every man good till he be convicted bad, and I assume it came not within the compass of an indictment. The conclusion is this. I had too many patrons for so slender a work, and for that fault this apology is my sufficient answer. Neither is it strange to have so much money for 6 verses, since bonum quo communius eo melius, and poetry in a more legitimate age hath been held cousin germain to goodness. But were there no more holes in this vessel, you might soon stop the leak.
And we will pause there briefly, because I think we've got this is the big meat. There's an awful lot of data here. I before we get to the data, I do love the way of going, I am but a hurt deer chased by hellhounds. And I just lost it there. I love that. Okay.
Damn those beagles.
So he's got no money. He's come down from Scotland and he thinks, them at the Globe, they're coining it in. They are. It's easy to put on a show. I'll put on a show and get lots of money. And yes, yeah, so it looks, according to him, he was doing the prologue, but the bailiffs came for him, and so he ran away. So it wasn't he ran away and the bailiffs went after him. He claims he was effectively chased off the stage and his prologue became an epilogue. Now, he also promises that he's going to perform this next term. And in fact, next year, in 1615, he does perform, there is a performance of England's Joy. Now, of course, whether he's written it in the interim, he's had 12, 13 years to get something down, or whether he's just actually finally plucked up the courage to write to present his opus in a more controlled space. It seems to be that, there were too many people came to see it, maybe he ran because the multitude turned on him because it was clearly going to be shit. So, again, there's all these questions. Was it a deliberate fraud? Or was it Winter Wonderland?
Well.
Because that's now, for me, the sort of the how I'm seeing this show.
The two aren't mutually exclusive.
The audience have turned up being told that there's going to be a wonderful Santa's grotto and a palace of delights, and they've got a gnome smoking a fag in a grotty car park. And that's what they got. But he's sort of claiming that, the show would have been great if someone had given me a chance to say more than 6 lines. That's his argument. What do you believe? Do you believe, behind all the whining, is this actually true?
I'm willing to believe that it wasn't a deliberate fraud, but I don't believe that he could have produced a show that all of these people would have considered worth all of that money.
Mm. I'm thinking this whole thing is a fraud, actually. I think I have spent too many hours in the company of the fictional George Peel. Because it's bred in me a cynicism that that I can't shake off, because this is exactly like the kind of thing that he would come up with. It's the kind of scheme he would come up with. And then he would spend hours protesting his innocence, saying, "Oh, but it was just that the bailiffs came and they chased me and I didn't get a chance. And my prologue became an epilogue. And oh, and my life's been so awful, you wouldn't believe." And all the time he's just thinking, "Ooh, and what can I write next?"
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because, you know, he talks about the Globe coining it on Bankside. And of course, Globe is still pretty new at this point. It's only a couple of years since it's been built. It's a not unimportant theatre company. You know, they are doing quite well by reasonable expectations. It's very difficult to tell how well people are actually doing, but I think this is evidence that the Globe is actually doing quite well at this point. And the casual person wandering past goes, "Well, they're clearly coining it because look at all these people coming in and out." Of course, not having a clue how theatre actually works. But also, this is slightly going against my saying, you know, that maybe the plot we've got isn't a playbill, but actually the way he describes it does seem like the multitude were expecting all of these things. That this, you know, this is how he advertised it. But he's talked about his debts. He's given us motive for a massive fraud. And he's said that it's about making a profit, that, you know, obviously it's very easy to make a profit. He's looked at the business model of the Globe. Ah, penny for the cheapest seat. Well, if I charge a shilling, then I'll make 12 times as much money. That's genius. Why aren't they doing it? I mean, the other modern example would be the Fyre Festival.
Oh, God, yes.
Where again, massive privilege insulates you from the fact that you don't know what you're doing. And this is the thing, this guy clearly hasn't got a fucking clue what he's doing. He just thinks, "Oh, it's easy. I'll just get some of my mates to come on stage and do some dumb show stuff." And again, it suggests, okay, that I presented you with a dumb show. That's because the dumb show is him running away, not necessarily the show itself. I mean, that's the dumb show the audience got to watch before they took the theatre down. Again, according to him. Alan.
I must admit, the resonances I'm getting is either the celebrations around the Millennium Dome, which of course happened a year before the Millennium itself, or the clusterfuck this year that was built, the renamed Festival of Brexit.
Yes. Well, I mean, there's two fundamental differences with those, in the sense that they, for the most part, existed. Certainly in terms of the Millennium Dome, people went to it, and, you know, a lot of people did actually, some people actually enjoyed it. Some people still speaks about that they had a great time. They are both quite hollow festivals. I think it's fair to say the Millennium Dome didn't really have a particularly strong core central thesis. And Festival of Brexit, because they wanted to rebrand it as anything other than the Festival of Brexit, had no meaning very, very quickly. And so lots of that didn't properly happen, but that doesn't mean to say they were, at least they did hand the jobs to professionals for the most part. So it is quite different in that sense, of something that may be perceived as being not very successful as opposed to something that didn't happen.
I do feel that the Fyre Festival / Winter Wonderland analogy is useful, because in both those cases, I think, yes, on the one hand, you have a huge amount of entitlement coupled to incompetence. But on the other hand, it's like the fact that there was a huge amount of entitlement coupled to incompetence doesn't necessarily mean that it wasn't also a scam. You know, it's like, well, this is a total shit show and it was bound to fail because look at the people who were organising it. Well, yes, because they clearly aren't professionals and don't know what they're doing. But on the other hand, that doesn't mean that their intent wasn't nefarious, that they weren't actually planning to rip people off, and the whole thing was just a very cynical money-making exercise.
I think it's that division, you know, it clearly isn't going to be value for money. I mean, they're greedy. He's definitely greedy here in terms of what he's selling. But, you know, is it a deliberate, is, you know, was he always meaning to just get on a horse and run away? Was the horse ready? Was the getaway car, was its driver sat with his foot on the pedal?
Well, clearly not.
No. Well, this is the thing. You know, and say, what was the cue for him to run? Was it the Beatles coming for him? Or was I'm inclined to think that it's more he started doing the speech, things. The audience went for him, he ran, someone called for the Beatles, they got him. That sort of feels like a reasonable compromise, but it may not be there. Anyway, we should gather more evidence. It's going to get a little less on point, but it will keep ebbing and flowing in and out. So we'll read for quite a while and see what we get. I don't know who we left off with. I'll start with Aliki and then Alan and Sarah, and we'll go around in that way.
I have forgot the inner temple. Is that it?
Yeah. Yes.
I have forgot the inner temple, you will say. And I think many of you never came at it, where I molted in my old age. The truth is naked. I can hardly find a cloak for this tempest. I must profess, ingeniously, I call this an affliction, and that is near a sufferance, I should say, as I must, if I dare speak the truth. I felt injustice.
This I will say, my judges were my executioners, and I never saw the scale and the sword pictured in one hand before. Had I been guilty of wrong to them, I must have had a great opinion of my wit or my power. On the other side, my known disgrace from such unquestionable judgments will hardly endure a plea of innocence. And for ignorance, it will not save me through a mistaking of the matter. Knowing my person needed no query, brought me to feel that which they recompense with money as an injury, which Master Taus, the worshipful and grave bencher of the house, is a sufficient witness to, who paid it. So that this, the most mortal wound in the eye of many, is but a mountebank's poison, swelled with a toad and healed with a spider.
Many see the hurt, whom I cannot acquaint with the cure. I therefore this aver, that a sum of money was set down and paid me in satisfaction of that wrong done unto me by the commandment of that most honourable wise and learned counsellor of estate, the now Lord Chancellor of England, who, being himself the principal flower of the law, yields a sweet-smelling favour of his virtues to all the professors thereof, leading them the way of right and equity by his just example. If this be true, as how can it be otherwise, producing such instances? The fault lies in your incredulity, not my honesty, for men use not to give satisfaction of right but wrong. If this position of divinity be also true, as unquestionable it is, that conscientia accusat vel condemnat, I shall not fear sentence for this crime. But I am homo multorum scalarum, you will object, and so many smokes cannot be got without some fire. How can I hurry away with my coach and four horses from Sir John Spencer's accusation of me, as was falsely alleged, instead of requiting an injury or concession of a wrong therein done to me? The fleet possessed me. I think the phrase suits me, for never was distressed man so conjured. Take this ex-confesso. I was coram justice and committed for the fact supposed for £500. And the Honourable Lord Cook, now Lord Chief Justice of England, his name used for the money. Should I only recite for myself the fable which Aesop told the men of Delphos, being unjustly to suffer death, I imagine it will not be from my purpose which thus comes to you.
A country gentleman, having never been in the city, and hearing some courtier in the progress belike utter the commendation of the freedom, resolved with himself to see whether truth was always clad in purple, and for that purpose put a couple of asses into his cart, now called a coach, and makes for the city. The beasts, being great enemies to smoke, took a more open way, and being now overtaken with night, the poor gentleman, finding himself in an inevitable place of danger, cries out, How unwelcome art thou, death! Not for thine own sake, but for that thou art presented to me by such ignoble and dull creatures. Had I suffered by horses, nay, mules, it would have been possible to men of quality. But falling by long-eared cattle at the best, I can be esteemed but a carrier.
Surely, good people, I'm no better mounted then than was this gentleman. My grief is the same, for if I should put you in the way, instead of the ostrich, you would choose to bruise on thistles, though your own gums bleed. Though I be not free, I will not fail my direction. Howsoever, I am sure to find you benighted.
There was a project in the time of Sir John Watts, his mayoralty, for a mask to be presented by the citizens at court. The Christmas following at the marriage of the Lord Hayes to the daughter and heir of the worthy Lord Denny, wherewith I had acquainted the King's Majesty, who gave a gracious allowance thereto, for the furtherance whereof the noble-minded Lord Mayor, moved by a letter from the recorder, Sir Henry Montagu, under his hand, promised that if I could procure £1,000 to be tendered at his house in London towards that business, he would double it. £500 whereof Sir Stephen Soame undertook for me, the other £500 I moved to Sir John Spencer, and going beyond my commission, used an honourable person's name to him, not to lend me the money or to part with a groat, but rather for his sake to further the intendment by such a tender to be made and returned by his own servants. The knight was wise. His wealth spoke no less. Suspicion and wisdom are sisters. You will say my name carried doubt enough in it. Before the hour appointed for the tender, I was apprehended, carried before the Chief Justice to be examined. The truth of my meaning appeared by Sir Stephen Soame, who, being sent for that purpose, cleared me before those lords, and that honourable person being present, whose name I used, by free pardon purged me from that boldness. Thereupon I pleaded my discharge. It may be in too rough a phrase. I was taught manners, and I hope, my brethren, you will not lay this as a sin to my charge, being yourselves yet to learn.
I lay long in prison, not from want of cause to be released, but in desire to know the ground of my restraint. The point controversed is the fault. I have a knight for the foreman of my jury, who gave up his verdict of not guilty to the indictment. If I lay by it for want of sureties for the good behaviour, rudeness is a less ill than cozenages. Of the one I have proved myself guiltless, and from the other I appeal to them which know what provoked authority can do. It was a just wish, though impossible, of the poet, that desired none to judge but they that knew how to write. I wish I had no more judges than could tell how to read. Ignorance is not only an enemy to art, but to virtue. Salvabimur si separemur acetu, saith wise Seneca. It is your act makes me condemned. Well, said Cicero of you, the valiant rabble, you had good left hands, ill right. Your blows fall without defence, but as it is the easiest thing to accuse, so you that have no art in taking out of hard lessons seldom clear any, at least not without passion, which makes your estimation the same it is, and myself, from Diogenes' search, when I often hear myself calumniated by your impure gums, wish I had a man to my accuser, but seeing my desire impossible, I have of late imitated Arcadia the Macedonian, who, forsaking his country because of Philip, was overtaken by a sudden siege of his at Delphos, of whom the king, demanding whether he fled, answered, to the country where no man knew Philip. This, I say, hath caused me to make my late abode in two noble counties of Kent and Essex, of whom I may say, if any object there are some of that brood, if any object there are some of that brood there, sure I have met with none, but on the contrary, with those many, with many gentlemen of great rank and quality, who like themselves did use me nobly, making those counties by their generous conversation seem to me a summer garden full of delight and pleasure. But for that, I may not be so ungrateful to those worthy personages there remaining to mingle them under one chapter with the adulterated seed, I will here give an end to the first part of this, my apology, which is mine own defense. And for the second part, which is my merit, appeal from the Jews to Festus and Agrippa, and with Lentulus, who accused the ambition of Pompey, now defended by the acclamation of the multitude, cry out, acclamate quirites dum licet, iam enim impune non licedit.
And there we will stop, because I skimmed through the second part, and it basically seems to be a never-ending arse-licking of noble types. I don't think there's any more useful data to the England's Joy incident. I mean, basically, the sort of end of this story is, you know, he doesn't actually get prosecuted for this. You know, as was mentioned earlier in the either the letter or the diary entry, you know, the Lord Chief Justice goes and just goes, oh, bounds him over to keep the peace or something, and you know, £5 to appear at the sessions, but you know, the case doesn't go anywhere. Which does suggest that there's enough evidence that some sort of show was possibly happening, that and he's just basically left his own devices. Any thoughts on that sort of lengthy little chunkette that we closed on? I mean, an awful lot of name dropping, mentioning of Sir John Watts, who was a Lord Mayor in 1606 to 7. We don't have a pageant for him, I'm afraid. We've done all the Lord Mayor shows, or pretty much all the ones that we can. But sadly, it was a plague year, so didn't get one by the time. Which is, it must have come on late, thinking about it, because the King of Denmark came in 1606. So maybe plague descended. Maybe he brought it. Any additional thoughts about the his money troubles, shall we say? any additional thoughts, Alan?
There does seem to be a considerable amount of excess protestation. I mean, I wouldn't trust this guy with a used writ.
It just never ends, does it? I mean, I say it never ends. There are still more pages of this stuff. And I'm going to be kind and not make you read it, because as I say, I don't think it's going to give us any more data. I could be wrong. There might be some additional, you know, nuggets to dig out there. There is one more bit of data I want to throw in, which I consider primary source data. Which we can go for. But anyway, yeah. Any more thoughts on the bit we just read, Sarah?
It's not really so much a bit on the, well, yes, it is a thought on the bit we've just read, but it's more on like what you were saying, the fact that he was only, you know, fined £5, you know, taken as evidence that there was some genuine intent to stage a show. It could be that, or it could just be that he does actually know a lot of useful people, which, you know, clearly he does. Or, I mean, you know, he makes no bones about that. So, yeah, the fact that he got off with quite a light fine, I don't think that's necessarily a sign that he wasn't trying to fleece everybody.
Where did the money go?
Where did the money go? That?
I mean, did they try to redistribute it to the audience? I don't think that's going to happen. I mean, it's not like they got ticket stubs.
I'm sure there would have been an account of that if it had happened. I mean, that would have been something quite extraordinary. No, that money went into somebody's pocket, and I'm betting it was his.
Well, if it did, it disappeared pretty. I mean, this man seems to spend money like water. He's always in debt, and say his family has had lengthy, complicated legal problems, which say is slightly outside our ambit here. I mean, it's just fair to say he was short of a bob or two, considering his status. So, in theory, the next year, it was staged. Somewhere, we don't know where. Around about the same time, sadly, Richard Venner, he's imprisoned. We've had references to him being imprisoned variously. He's imprisoned this time at the Wood Street Compter, So jail off Wood Street, and he dies on the 13th of October, 1615. So a year after writing this, he's in prison again. I'm assuming the Wood Street Compter is a debtor's prison, and he, as I say, he dies there. But around about the same time, the play was performed. Maybe it was a benefit to try and pay his debts. But the text did seem to suggest that it was in preparation when he was writing the apology. And a chap called William Fenner, not Venner, Fenner, performed in it. And it was seen by a chap called John Taylor, who he wrote this. This excerpt. Now, this I haven't been able to get the whole poem. He wrote a poem called A Cast Over the Water. So I have just lifted this from the fabulous Lost Plays database, which has much of this. It doesn't have the whole account of Richard Venner's apology. It just has little bits and pieces. But it did have this chunk of A Cast Over the Water. So I couldn't get a copy of it. I was most annoyed. And John Taylor says this about the performance within England's Joy by a chap called William Fenner. Thou brag'st what fame thou got'st upon the stage. Indeed, thou set'st the people in a rage in playing England's Joy, that every man did judge it worse than that was done at Swan. I never saw poor fellow so behissed. To applaud thee, few or none lent half a fist. Some stinkards' hands, perhaps, went pit to pat, who ignorantly liked, they knew not what. Besides, thou knowest, thou promised in thy bill, in rare extempore, to show thy skill. When all thou spokest, thou studiedst had before, thou knowest, I know, above a month and more. Besides, the best conceits that were in it, poor fool, thou hadst them from a better wit than is thine own. Thy beggarly conceit could ne'er have mounted to so high a height. I think it's fair to say John Taylor wasn't impressed. He also says somewhere in the poem, I say it's quite annoying I don't have the full thing, it references a rumour that Fenor had swindled poor old Venor, that plain-dealing man who acted England's Joy first at the Swan. So the deceiver is by thee deceived. So there's a double-edged thing there, suggesting that Venor, who was a swindler, was swindled himself there. I would like the rest of that. We have also, at some point, read a reference to England's Joy in a play. I wasn't here for the play. I did tell Eric in my absence, if anyone asked what the England's Joy reference was about, that he could tell people what it was about. Nobody asked, so it didn't crop up. So, but there are lots and lots of references to England's Joy. It basically becomes a byword for con artists, and that was in The Three English Brothers. Which you did reasonably recently. Ben Jonson has a go. Lots of people have a go in various plays. It gets a name check every so often, and I'm sure we'll all nod sagely now when we come to those references and go, know what you're talking about, Sarah.
I am amazed that no one wrote a play of this. that Ben Jonson or somebody didn't turn this whole thing into a play, because it would make an absolutely great one, and they would have had their built-in marketing, because the fact that, you know, people knew what England's Joy was and it became this byword for conning and disaster. I mean, it's a gift. I assume there is no play. No one's written a play after 1615 about this whole debacle and turns it into a piece of high farce. No one actually does that.
It's a wasted
opportunity.
I have to say, there is this question now of what to do with this particular text. I mean, you know, we could do an audio book of the apology, but it's not that interesting. I mean, it's got some lovely turns of phrase, but it's not. It would be rather tedious, a listen, even with a good reader, especially without context. But yeah, you could do a quite a nice little dramatised episode of the podcast on this. I mean, the question is, of course, we have to. You have to take a line then, unless you're going to do a Rashomon with it. Mm. You know, you have to decide whether he's actively conning everyone or whether he's just incompetent. And okay, there's only four of us in the room now. You've heard all. I think all the primary evidence as to what happened directly. And I'll ask our viewers and listeners at home, you know, in the comments, email us, put on the Twitter, con man or incompetent. I'm going to ask the room now, hands up for con man and incompetent. It's a 50-50 split.
Actually, I put my hand up for both because I think he was probably both. I think he was probably trying to con people and was also massively incompetent.
Well, yes, he was clearly incompetent because he got caught. I mean, yeah. It's a very different... If he got away with it... Alan?
I think, actually, you've probably got, and again, a modern resonance, a posh, entitled chap who thinks he can get away with it. You know, and absolute contempt for the multitude, which comes through the whole thing of it.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, his character, I mean, beyond just lifting actual paragraphs from this, it writes itself, doesn't it? Because he's so clearly embittered by the fact that he thinks he should get the moon on a string. And the world just says, fuck you. Sarah,
I'm also like, given that the difference between Venner and Fenner is a tiny fraction of upper teeth placement, I'm also wondering if the Fenner who ripped off Venner was actually the brother-in-law swindled him out of the money in the first place. Because if I was writing a play of this, that's exactly who he would turn out to be.
I mean, I don't know. I suspect it's just a coincidence. There were, I think, quite a lot of Venners. I was just scrabbling around with, you know, some of the court cases he was involved in. His family were involved in some really complicated stuff earlier in his life, which is sort of alluded to here, but not very clearly. And there have been an awful lot of disentangling of that. There is, there is an article that's on JSTOR on this, which you can access if you sort of do your login for however many a month or whatever it is you can sign up for. Herbert Berry has, I don't know if that is a chap, has done something on that, on his, his sort of backstory of his legal troubles and debts and things. I haven't attempted to disentangle that because it's not really our remit. But hey, the life and times of Richard Venner, theatrical impresario, failed. I almost think, actually, you could do it like a documentary, couldn't you? A sort of you know, I was there. I got the hangings. I got a stool. I love that detail. They nick the stools.
And the walls.
Yeah, I mean, they nicked a lot. There's interesting elements when you go to the bit that's specifically about the events, and he's talking about, you know, people continue to vilify me for a bad play, basically. And, you know, there's so many playwrights who get hissed off the stage these days, you know, and they're still lauded as great, great artists. Why am I not one of them? Yeah.
It's just kind of fabulous, isn't it? Mm. I forgot what I was going to say. Carry on.
Yeah. Alan?
The only possible rationale I can find for his apology is that this was pre-publicity material for the either revival or the upcoming production. Mm. You know, yeah. it was a spin doctor press release to try and shell up a bit more business.
Mm. Yeah, Aliki.
I'm not sure I buy that since, you know, on the one hand, he keeps referring to the multitude as the revolting mob. It's like, go away, audience, I don't want you. And on the other hand, part of his problem in the first place was apparently having too large an audience. Mm.
Or I mean, there's a slight ambiguity to that statement because it was this question of, you know, was it for the number of words, it was too great a number, you know, for the amount of prologue he actually got out. He does a lot with his hunting reference, doesn't he? This simile he uses, he makes a lot of that. At the highest rate, you lent me but an afternoon's hearing, the expectation being worth the money. Yeah. It's maybe just he bigged it up too much. That was the problem. For the between the price and the bigging upness. Sarah?
Do you know, I do buy Alan's theory. This whole thing was a publicity stunt to drum up money for the revival. Because actually, if you're really rude about your punters, there is a certain subsection of them who are going to turn up, you know, to abuse you. And also, like, the fact that this whole England's Joy thing, this tag was still following him around, like, 12 years later or whatever it was. It's like, really? Were people really still recognising him in the street and going, oi, England's Joy? It's like, I don't know so much. I'm wondering if this whole thing, this whole, like, oh, I have been so injured and abused, and, you know, I think the whole thing could just be like a very savvy bit of negative publicity that is there to whip up curiosity and outrage before the. I mean, it's like when a Hollywood film tackles a controversial subject. I'm thinking in particular of a Mel Gibson film that shall remain nameless. But sections of the community get so hot and frothy about it and start protesting it before it's even been released. And then, of course, everybody goes to see what is actually a pretty shit film and probably would have sunk without a trace without it. I'm wondering if there's a bit of that going on here.
Mm. Alan?
I think it was not people in the street taking the mick out of him. I think it was probably the other benchers at the Inn of Court. You know, it was the people he regarded as being his peers, well, or close inferiors, who were taking the mick. And I must admit, the thought that crossed my mind was there's almost an element in it, the story you may remember from a few years ago when Gerald Ratner fell from grace. When he made an analogy between the products he was selling on the high street, well, they actually cost about the same as a prawn cocktail sandwich and last for about as long.
Okay, right. Well, I think we've come to the as much of a conclusion as we can. I was just trying to figure out what mask this was supposed to be presented by the citizens at court at Christmas, but I don't have time to properly look that up and see if that actually is a thing that we have any references to. But there's all sorts of little avenues to go with. I'm very keen, I say, to do something a little more proper with this in an adaptatory kind of way. I don't think I'll inflict upon the podcast a full reading of this. I'm actually very tempted to just release this on the podcast itself as well as the YouTube channel, because I've had so much fun with this. I've really enjoyed this session. All that remains then is to thank all our wonderful readers for all our wonderful reading. Thank you very much, everyone, and goodbye. I felt injustice.